So I was told yesterday there was some confusion during the tutorial about the spreading of correlation functions. So I will quickly show you. So the thing that we would like to show is that if we start in a state that has a certain correlation length chi, in order to get a longer correlation length that is chi plus xi, we need to wait a time that is given by the Lieb-Robinson bound. Okay? So we need to have the distant parts of the system to talk in order to increase the correlation length. So how do we spell this? So we start from the fact that we are in a state psi that has correlation length chi. Okay. So what does it mean? It means that whenever we take two operators based at P and Q, their connected correlation functions will decay exponentially with the distance between P and Q and characteristic length chi, right? This is what it means. The distance between P and Q over chi. Okay. So this is our starting point. This is the there is no time here. What is the time? This is, we are in a state psi, and we have operators OP and OQ, and we're calculating the correlation length in this state. So this is the, these expectation values are taken in this state. Okay? It's some state. We are in a state psi that has correlation length chi. It could be the ground state of some Hamiltonian. It could be not. But it is a state that has correlation length chi, which means this. But if, this is what it means to a correlation length chi. Yeah.
So the operators OP and OQ, this inequality is valid for the first, I mean, for t equals 0 or any time? Because if I have both the operators, then the first port would be the whole.
Right. So this is an operator with support on P. This is an operator with support on Q. And in this state, they have and the correlation length of this state is chi, which means just this. So I am I'm trying not to, I don't want to humor your question in the sense at what time. There is no time here. That is the operator OP with the support in P. Okay? So if you want, it's a time equals 0, but you, there is no time now at this point. Okay? So you have two operators with the support P and Q. These two supports are at the distance dpq. The state having correlation length chi means this. Okay? So this is our starting point. Now imagine that we take this psi and we evolve it in time now. Okay? So we change psi using a local time evolution. So psi goes in u of t of psi with u of t that is given by some local Hamiltonian h. Okay? Or which is the same okay, no. So let me say like this. And I ask myself, now this is a different state, psi of t. How big has t to be in order to increase the correlation length? from chi to chi plus something. Okay, so this is the problem. So we want to know that what is the, now imagine we have two operators based on A and B. Okay? And we want to know what is the correct, how we can bound this object, right? Do they still decay exponentially? And now we take the thing in psi of t in the new state. So taking it in the new state is the same than computing the correlation function of the time evolved operators. In the old state, right? We know that. It's just the Heisenberg representation. So far, so good. Okay. Okay, so now we see that. So now we are taking the expectation value of these operators in the old state, right? So formally, in the old state, we still have correlation length chi, right? But why now we cannot take this bound and use it here? Why I cannot put dAB here? Why I cannot take this thing with the distance between A and B? I mean, I can, right? Because the state has correlation length psi. And so it means that this is bounded by e to the minus dAB over chi. But why this is dumb? Huh? Because the distance is zero. Because now these operators have support everywhere, so their distance is zero. So if I just apply what I already know, I get something true that is, and of course here there is some constant, right? C1. It's decaying like that, but there is some prefactor that fixes, that takes in account what are basically the norms of these operators. Okay. So we need to do something else. Okay. So the crucial point about the Lieber-Robinson bounds is that it is true that OA of T has support everywhere, but the relevant part of this support is within the light cone. So we want to define a light cone that is given by some distance minus Vt. And we want to say, I can approximate this operator with an operator that has not support everywhere, but just in the light cone. And if I do that, I do an exponentially small error. Okay? So lemma. OA of T, and similarly OB of T, can be approximated by OA, let me put L here, of T. Where, by this I mean an operator that has support. So this one has support everywhere, right? We know that. But this one has support in the region A plus some distance L from A. Okay? And L and T are gauged in a way that they are in the light cone. So that the spins are in the light cone of A. Okay, so how do we do that? Let me define S as the spins at distance greater than L from A. Okay, so the spins that are outside this ring. Okay, so let me define this operator. So the operator that is OA of t, but restricted to this region. It's just those to do. So I take OA of t. I trace out whatever is outside of this. So I trace out s. Okay. So now this is an operator that has support only on this, on this part, by definition. And then, because my state is a state on the whole Hilbert space, I also have to specify what is the state outside. And we would like to, and we define it as the state that takes into account all the possible configurations with the same weight. So what is called the completely mixed state. So on S, we have the identity on S over the dimension of S. Okay? No, that's true, but on S is the identity. The identity commutes with everything. Okay? So the influence of a distance is given by the fact that something fails to commute. So here it's just the identity on everything. Just like when we say that a local operator has support, in fact, to be fair, this exactly means that it has support just on here. The support is where the operator is non-trivial, but it's not the identity. Okay, so we need to prove this lemma. And by this, I mean that they are close in a trace distance. Means that we cannot distinguish them easily with some measurement. Okay, so let's show that. So we want to show that OA of t minus OLA of t is small. So it's smaller than something. So we want to produce bounds. Okay, so in order to do that, we use a result of functional analysis that says every time I integrate, if I take the average of some operator on the Hilbert space, the average of this operator is equal to that operator computed on the completely mixed state. So in other words, the completely mixed state is the average state in the Hilbert space. Okay? So this is a theorem that is a very beautiful result in group theory. And so in order to take this average, we must have a measure on all the possible states or unitaries, because it's the same, because they map one to the other on the Hilbert space. So we have a measure called the mu u that is called R measure. So the R measure is very important, because this is how we do measure theory on the Hilbert space, which means this is how we, so it's not just math, this is how we do probability theory in the Hilbert space. If we want to know how likely it is something to happen in the Hilbert space, then we, you know, likeliness is measure theory. It means what part of the volume of the Hilbert space has that property. And the R measure is the only measure that is unitarily invariant, means that if I have some volume and I do a unitary transformation, it stays, that this volume doesn't change. Okay? So this is what defines the R measure. So in particular, let me do just unitary transformation only on S. Okay? So I do not do the average on the whole Hilbert space, but only on the Hilbert space that is outside that region. So you have to use this equality. So this is a theorem. If I average my operator that I support everywhere on some region US, what I get is the whatever is outside the region S times the completely mixed state. Okay. So now we put this thing in here. And we use the fact that this is the trace distance. So I gain a bound because I put the norms inside the integral. And this is the commutator between US and OA of T. You see, when I use this representation, then instead of OL of T, I have this object that only contains OA of T. So in the end, I can do this. This is just one passage in between which you make the commutator appear by using the cyclicity of the trace that is the trick that we used many times. Okay. Oh, very good. Now we can apply the Lee Robinson bound for all these terms. So we get some constant, that depends on this integration. And then we get E to the minus. Okay. What do we get? So what is the distance between A and S? Well, depends, right? But it is at least L by definition. And we have a length scale psi that, as we know from the Lee Robinson bounds, is given by the details of the Hamiltonian and of the graph. So this is the Lee Robinson bound. And this is just the assumption of the correlation length. Okay? Very good. So now that we know this, now that we know that I can approximate this operator with this operator, sorry, and the OB with the same in the same radius, I can just bound this using my Lee Robinson bound. Okay, let's do that. So I'm using it two times, right? So I have So all I've done here is to take my original operators and say, oh, I approximate them with something that is within the light cone of A and B, and they make some error that is this. So actually, I stand corrected. My error is, yeah, so the difference between these two is bounded in this way. Okay, so what I have to do is this. So instead of this, I use this. This means that at most I make an error of this way. When I take the absolute values, it shows up as a plus. Okay, you agree with this? Okay, well, now we are done. Because now this is the correlation function in the state psi of operators that do not have support everywhere. Where does this one, by definition, have support on? On A plus L. And this one has support on B plus L. So their distance, the distance between these two, is the original distance between A and B minus 2L. It's not zero. So now I use the fact that there is a correlation length chi here. So this is bounded by C1 e to the minus the distance between A and B, which is dAB minus 2L over chi. And then we have plus 2C2 e to the minus L minus BT over xi. And then you do some algebra and you write it as something that decays exponentially in chi plus xi. So this boring part. We are done here. Okay. So this is the proof that in order to have a correlation length chi plus xi, somehow we have to wait a time t that is of the order of L over V. Okay. No, let me use the front. Okay. So imagine that I have a, okay, so what I want to, now we change topic, but we will use all these things that we have learned. And what we want to understand is still this old question, what is a quantum phase? So we have learned something. So we know that a quantum phase is a domain of regularity of the geometric tensor, which also means that I can connect states that are in this domain in some continuous way. This continuous way is called quasi-adiabatic connectivity. It's called quasi-adiabatic because if you really wanted to do it adiabatically using time evolution, you would make a small error. And this small error is bound by the Lieb-Robinson bound. Okay? So it's not perfectly adiabatic, but it's quasi-adiabatic. So quasi-adiabatic connectivity is possible when Q mu nu is regular, and it is understood in this way. So I define, imagine that I have H of G is some Hamiltonian depending on, so G of course is a set of parameters. And then we have some evolution operator, that is the time order product of e to the minus a integral between 0 and s of h of g of s in the s. So this is a curve in the space of the parameters. And let's say that psi, we start from some state psi. Then we can have psi of s that is just us psi. Okay. And all these states that are continuously connected to my initial state. So they form an equivalence class that we call a phase. So this is a quantum phase. And so This one now can think of it as the ground state of some Hamiltonian H tilde. So, yeah, we have given this mathematical definition that we are saying, oh, this is like the adiabatic theorem. So we must be sure that this is also the ground state of some Hamiltonian. Right? So in this sense, this is a manifold of quantum phases. They are the ground states of a Hamiltonian. So it's the equilibrium state at t equals zero of our system. Well, okay, so theorem. Psi of S is the ground state of H tilde of S equal US H U dagger S. I transform my initial Hamiltonian with my quasi-adiabatic continuation, and the state that I am transforming in the same way is the ground state to the new Hamiltonian. So this is the adiabatic theorem. So this is easy to show. What is not easy to show before we knew the techniques that we know now is that this new Hamiltonian is still a good quantum many-body Hamiltonian. Means this. So if this is the sum of local operators, so this is a local Hamiltonian, the initial one. Now, is this a local Hamiltonian? So just for what I showed in the underneath blackboard, yes. Because I am transforming every term of this Hamiltonian by means of this object, that is the time evolution in this time S with a local Hamiltonian. And we know that now all these operators are again local with a slightly larger support, but still local, apart from an exponentially small tail. Is this clear? I'm saying that every time I evolve in time some local operator, this is again local. I mean, it has a slightly larger support. Okay, that is, this L is equal VT. So similarly, exactly in the same way, this new Hamiltonian will have the same local terms than before, which the support increased by VS, but it's still a local Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is how we know that we are within a phase, okay? So at this point, there is really a question that comes in play, which is a bit unsettling, because it seems that there is some ambiguity, right? Because you see, now I am defining the different phases at the wave function level. I'm saying I start from some representative of the phase, then I move with some Hamiltonian. And until I get a quantum phase transition, that is when this cannot be defined anymore, because Q mu nu is not analytic anymore. So this theorem fails. Until then, I'm still in the same phase. All right. But now we see that we have a problem. Because, so, remember the quantumizing model, right? And we saw that, so I have my Hamiltonian H of G. And for G smaller than 1, I can continue my state adiabatically. And I am in the ferromagnetic phase. Whereas for G greater than 1, I am, exactly G equal 1, something fails. all these things go bad, and for g greater than 1, I am in the paramagnetic phase. Okay, but we also saw that if instead of using to move in the in the space of quantum states, that instead of using this Hamiltonian, so moving around along G, I use this one. So I am here at G smaller than 1. This is G greater than 1. And I can do a rotation. And I avoid this critical line. So this rotation is continuous. And now I have gone in the other phase continuously. So according to our way of thinking, they are in the same phase. So these two states are in the same phase or not? So what are your thoughts about it? Okay. So if the notion is independent of the path, then the disorder state and the ferromagnetic state are in the same phase. So you remember how this rotation operator was, right? It was my rotation around phi was the product of e to the I sigma z phi. Right? So in the traditional way, how do we distinguish the ferromagnetic phase from the paramagnetic phase? What is it that physically distinguishes them? What? Magnetization. Very good. And why here we have a magnetization and here we do not have a magnetization? Why there is an order parameter that takes spontaneous? Because of symmetry breaking. So here we have symmetry breaking, and here we do not have symmetry breaking. And what is symmetry breaking? Is some symmetry of the Hamiltonian that is broken at the ground state level. Okay? So this Hamiltonian has the symmetry. The point is that this Hamiltonian, because it contains this term, is explicitly breaking this symmetry. So if I disregard the symmetry, then I can connect two states that have different symmetry without encountering a phase transition. It is when I restrict myself, my resources are constrained to have a certain symmetry, then I force myself to hit the wall. So the picture that we seem to have is that if this is the space of all the possible quantum states, of all the possible quantum phases, if I do no symmetry, it seems I can connect any two states. But if I constrain my path to have some symmetry, then I have the possibility of quantum phase transitions, and my space splits in sectors labeled by different symmetries. Right? So this is the traditional way of thinking. However, until you do not think in terms of the wave function, and you only think from the beginning just in terms of symmetry, OK, I have a phase transition when I break a symmetry, you cannot even formulate this question, that is, how do we know that in absence of symmetry, I can always connect two states? So I know that in absence of symmetry, I can connect this one with this one. But because these two states were, from the beginning, chosen just because the only difference was they were breaking a symmetry. So how do I know that here we do not have some harder wall such that if I take any state in here, so I disregard the symmetry. And so if I disregard symmetry, all these faces are the same. But how do I know that I cannot go, that I can always go here? In other words, is this part of the phase diagram exhaustive of all the possible quantum phases or not? Are there quantum phases that are not distinguished by symmetry? So if I disregard the symmetry, do I have states that I cannot connect? So this is the big question. And you can only think of this question if you first think of phases in this way. Okay, so many of the next lectures are a way to answer this question. And you remember that, so this question is, do we have quantum phases beyond symmetry? And with this fancy word, I just mean what I explained here. Okay. And the other question that we formulated yesterday, who remembers it? It was about the, so we know for sure, because we have a theorem, that if we have a unique ground state and a gap, then we have fast decay, exponential decay in correlation functions. And we know that in the quantum phase transitions that we know, this thing of having a unique ground state is essential, because we saw that when we have symmetry breaking, then we have a long range order, and then it's not true anymore. Even if you have a gap, correlation functions do not decay exponentially. So the other question is it possible to have degeneracy and finite correlation length? And these two questions are related. Because imagine that you have degeneracy and finite correlation length. So you know that you do not have an order parameter, right? Because if you had an order parameter, you would have long range order. So imagine that I am in some ground state, but it's, how do I know if it's unique or if there is another ground state that has maybe completely different properties? How do I know it? What do I measure? I do not have an order parameter. How do I even realize that this is the situation? Okay. At least from the experimental point of view, this is still an open question. So we have some good theoretical answer to this question, but none of them is really viable experimentally, which means that we have models that go beyond this paradigm. But it is very difficult to see it experimentally, at least. In these terms. Okay. So in order to convince you that this situation is even possible, the first thing we needed to show is that we start from a classical model. And then we will see that the quantum situation is much richer. We need to show that it is possible to have a statistical mechanical model that has a phase transition, but doesn't have any type of magnetization. So you know, in statistical mechanics, if you have a phase transition, usually there is a breaking of symmetry, and then there is magnetization, some spontaneous magnetization. So let, and this is always because we are breaking some global symmetry. Remember that these symmetries of the Hamiltonian that we are talking about are always global, in the sense that, for instance, the Z2 symmetry, we are flipping all the spins in, of the system, and we see that the energy of the Hamiltonian is the same. So when people started to thinking about lattice gauge theory, they just wanted to do gauge theory on a lattice. And this was necessary to do some calculations at the time in quantum chromodynamics, in try to regularize somehow. You know, you put a, you just look at the physics at low energy by putting a lattice spacing. Okay. So what is a lattice gauge theory? So first of all, we need to define a gauge transformation. So the gauge transformation, that is something very ambiguous in classical physics, but at least it should be something local. Okay. So let's see what we can do in a spin system. So lattice gauge theory, and this one we call it lattice icing gauge theory. It was invented by Wegener in 1971. And it's a beautiful theory. Let's see. So imagine that we are on a d-dimensional cubic lattice. Okay. We label the nodes of this lattice by n, and the links of this lattice by, let me use this notation, n and the vector mu. Okay, so in this way, for instance, let me take one plaquette in the cubic lattice. This will be the site n. This will be the site n plus mu, because I'm moving one step in the mu direction. This will be the site n plus mu plus nu, because I'm also moving a step in the nu direction. So this is a plaquette in the mu nu plane. And this is just n plus nu. Okay? So this is how I label the sites. Now, this edge, this link is labeled by n comma mu. This one is labeled by n comma, sorry, n plus mu. So I start from n plus mu, and they move in the new direction. This one is n plus mu plus nu. And then I move in minus mu direction. Or equivalently, I could call it n plus nu mu, right? Because we don't care about the orientation. And lastly, this is n nu. Okay, so this is how we label everything. And we place icing variables, means numbers, on my links. So let me call them sigma z. On every link n mu, I place an icing variable that can be either plus one or minus one. Okay. And now we want to define a local transformation. Let me say gauge in parentheses, transformation. does the following. So I am at some site n. So this is in 3D. From n, I have 6 links that are coming out. Imagine that I have up, up, down, up, down, down. Then I define a transformation g at n. So in this sense, it's local. I'm not flipping all the spins on the lattice, but only those that come out from n. So I land in some other configuration. So this. Okay, I flipped the 6 spins. And now we want to find an energy that is invariant under this transformation. So just like the Ising model is an energy that is invariant under the global up-down transformation, now we want to find some energy that is invariant under this local transformation, wherever I place it, but every time it's local. Suggestions? Okay. Well, if I do an energy that sigma z, right? But when I make the transformation here, you see I change the sign of sigma z. It only works when I make the transformation here. So this is not good. So look at this object here. And look at this term. Just the product of sigma z around the placket. Let me write it once, and then I don't write it again. N mu sigma z n plus mu nu sigma z n plus nu mu sigma z n nu. So no matter where if I do the transformation somewhere else on the lattice, these things are not involved at all. But every time I flip all the spins that come out from here, I always have to flip 2 of them inside this product. So this is invariant. Okay? Can we generalize it? Is this the only term that is invariant? No, I mean as one term. Then of course every plaquette is invariant and the sum is invariant. But what else? Tony? Any closed path. Any closed path has this property. Then no matter where I transform, I get 2. So why we like this one? This is a closed path, right? So why we like in particular this one? Because it's the smallest one, and we want our energy to be as local as possible. Remember that we want our Hamiltonian to be the sum of the local operator or local operators. So this is the most local one. Okay, so I can say that my Hamiltonian is minus j, the sum over all the plaquettes p of this object. Now, for convenience, I will just write like this, and it's clear what I mean. So notice that I could use a quantum mechanical-like notation. I could encode, so if I have a spin configuration, so this means that for every link I've decided whether sigma z of L is plus 1 or minus 1. I could encode this configuration in a ket. Which is such that sigma z as an operator of L on this cat is equal its eigenvalue, that is plus one or minus one times. Right? I can do that. And if I do that, this term maps into the product of all the links that belong to the plaquette of this operator. And the gauge transformation becomes the product of all the links that come out from the site N of sigma x, because this is what is flipping me the spins in this space. And having made, using this notation doesn't make the model any more quantum than it was before. It's the usual thing. Everything is commuting. We just have spin configurations. It's just a way to encode these numbers in matrices. But okay. So let's keep this in mind because later on we will use it. Okay. So this is our energy. Yep.
So what would be wrong with having some sort of pairwise product for your Hamiltonian? So it would only be quadratic as opposed to quartic. So like if in a lattice site, like at N, just like product over all the, like take the sum over all two products around the site.
The sum of all
so
the...
like it's like have like N nu times N mu, and then plus, and then sort of like N
yeah.
mu, and then
so
N minus
check,
mu.
Check that it's not invariant.
Okay.
Check that if I flip
all the spins, not all the spins on the model, all the spins from one site, you can always find one site such that this term doesn't go into itself. Okay?
So the only gauge invariant terms are
the products of these spins along a closed path. And this is just the most local one. And this is so a product of gauge fields around the path. In people who do high energy, that it's called Wilson loop. And that's why Wilson loops are gauge invariant quantities. And this is the simplest gauge theory that you can imagine. It's called, not surprisingly, Z2 gauge theory, because the gauge group is just to flip. So it contains only two elements. It is the flipping and the identity. And if I flip twice, I go back. So it's like doing the identity. So this is my group, it's Z2. Okay? Just like the global Z2 in the Ising model. And this is the local version of it. So whereas the nearest neighbor two-body interaction is the invariant term under a global transformation, in order to have a term that is invariant a local transformation, we need a closed path. This is a fact. Okay, so now this is our model. Now we want to show that this model does not magnetize. How do we show it? So we have to do the same thing that we would have done for the Ising the classical Ising model. So what do we do usually? We want to compute the magnetization. So the expectation value of this quantity. So we already know, even in the Ising model, if you just compute this thing, it's zero, right? But what you do is that you place a small external magnetic field, right? It's like the initial conditions. This method is called method of sources. You compute your magnetization with the small source that is like a perturbation. You take the thermodynamic limit. Then you send H to zero. Right? And then you see if there is a residual magnetization. And we have seen that this happens when there is a certain energetic barrier between the positive magnetization set of configurations, the ones with the negative configuration. If you pay an energy that is extensive, Since also the entropy is extensive, there will be some critical temperature such that the energy can prevail over the entropy. You remember, this was one of the first things that we saw. Unless, of course, you are at T equals zero, and then it is possible, or, I mean, there is no entropic contribution, and even a finite energy, you know, you still prefer to be wherever you started from. But classically, you know, T equals zero really has very little meaning. Because unlike quantum phase transitions, it's just a point that you cannot reach, and that doesn't have you inherit any quantum properties at slightly larger temperature. OK, so we have to do this. So now we are in presence of this field. So what does it mean? It means that I am perturbing my energy with the term that is minus h, the sum over all the spin configurations. OK, so you know that this thing is the trace of e to the minus beta h sigma z l over the partition function. Right? This is how we take expectation values in statistical mechanics, where this is the h that contains the small field. Okay, so let's do that. So we have this, what is the trace? Is the sum over all the spin configurations. Sorry, here this is just the sum over L, not the sum. Here this is the sum over all the spin configurations. And here I have beta j sum plaquette sigma z sigma z plus h. Let me call the h tilde equal beta h l sigma z. I have 30 seconds left, so I cannot finish in time without taking time from David again. So, yeah. So tomorrow we start exactly from this point. And our next step is to compute the magnetization if we change our variables in a way that we do a transformation like this. Okay. And then we compare them and then we will see what happens. So usually when you do that for the Ising model, you will see that the expectation value in one case and the expectation value in the other case are completely different. If you take the thermodynamic limit, then you send H to zero and it remembers where it was, right? You cannot make, you know, you cannot go back. We'll do basically the same thing else and we'll see that this fails. Okay. Questions? Okay, see you tomorrow.